It's been a year since the Missouri River flooded parts of western Iowa and other states along the river, but some people in the region are still struggling for a full recovery. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters, Ben Kiefer is away. This hour we'll hear from farmers still struggling to grow crops on their land and a soil expert who will be studying soil fertility in the western part of the state. Later we'll talk with groups that have different ideas on how the Missouri River should be managed, whether to let the river run its natural course or increase control of the river flows. Join our conversation right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. A year after the Missouri River flooded homes, businesses, and farmland, people in western Iowa and other states along the river are still recovering, and the debate over how to manage the river has escalated. I'll check in with a soil expert and farmers trying to get their soil back to a functional state, and I'll also talk with groups involved in flood recovery efforts and hear their ideas on how to best manage the river from this point forward. Joining me via phone is Alan Ladd, a regional extension education director at Iowa State. He hosted flood teleconference calls and events in western Iowa during the flood. Alan, set the scene a bit for us and the timeline for the flood.
Yes, well, in late May, the Corps of Engineers notified everybody up and down the river from South Dakota through Missouri on both sides of the Missouri River that there would be an epic event of flooding. And it would be a very long duration event. Normally, most floods are just a few days or maybe even a week or so, and then they subside. This would be a several week or multi-month flood. And so most of the folks had approximately 2 weeks to prepare for that.
So tell me how you managed the day-to-day operations of this flood.
Well, obviously, we looked at the Corps of Engineers maps and what they thought would be the points that would be flooded and focused on those that would be flooded first. And as we worked with our different community groups and our community organizations active in disaster, or COAD, different county groups were activated and involved with that. Our local county emergency management folks were very, very active in that, along with local law enforcement. And as you might suspect, DNR, Highway Department of Transportation, Iowa State Patrol, all of those came into being because we were also flooding the interstate, Interstate 29. So that was something that was fairly unusual as well.
And you were overseeing about six counties, am I correct?
There were six counties within the state of Iowa that were flooded, and a coworker and I had the total responsibility within Extension and Outreach for doing that. And so what we did was to help get the word out with media, different things about resources that would be available, including hotlines that Iowa State operates for stress, preparations on who do I call to do X or how do I do Y, as in regards to just things that we had not experienced before at the local level.
And this flood lasted well over 100 days. How prepared were you for this level of a catastrophe?
Well, you can prepare and write plans and so forth, but eventually with a flood or an event that happens of this duration, it's somewhat you kind of have to shift and make do as you go along. And each day obviously was something new or something different. The media was really involved as far as getting the word out for us, and we certainly appreciate that. But as the flood wore on, obviously the attention from those outside of the flood area kind of waned, and it became very hard to kind of generate support or interest for people who had not gone through something like that before. And so then it became a out of sight, out of mind for folks if you weren't immediately involved. And you know, when we have bright, sunshiny days and high temperatures, people forget about flooding. And so as we think through the 100 days of the whole summer and early fall, the flood was still there.
And have you assessed how you could manage this better next time, or did things go pretty smoothly and now you have the standard operation procedure?
Well, I would say any time that you do a major disaster like this, that you can always look back and learn lessons from that. Our community organizations active in disaster at the county level, either the ones that were established or the ones that are establishing now, have been utilizing their lessons and trying to strengthen their plans and so forth with that. And, of course, every disaster is a little bit different. And I recall one piece of advice I was given, and this was actually during the 1993 floods, was that a flood is the worst type of disaster that you can have. You never know when it's going to end. When we think about other disasters, whether it's a windstorm or a tornado or a fire, usually within a few minutes or a few hours, the disaster is over, and then we can start going and doing recovery, cleanup, et cetera. And with the flood, there were people that weren't able to even access their property until September, October. Folks then had to let things dry out, to prepare, to move back in. And so I know personally of some coworkers who were not able to move in until January.
And we'll check in with some people later on in the show that experienced this flood and had to deal with it firsthand. But why was this flood so detrimental compared to floods in the past?
I think just because it was so long, because when you move out or away from your home, your farmstead, your business, you want to get back in and start doing something, cleaning up immediately. And there was no immediacy to this. It was wait, wait, wait. And that's what then a lot of the stress set in for folks. And as we think about people, you say, well, come on over, your family, your friends, you can stay with me. And after a week or so, then, well, the people that were hosting family and friends going, this isn't quite what I expected, and it's a lot more stressful, and our lives are disrupted too. How do we work through this? And so then some of our hotlines for counseling and those kinds of things became much, much more important. There was anger and frustration with government agencies, such as the Corps of Engineers, the Department of Transportation. Why couldn't they do more? Why couldn't they do it sooner? Those kinds of things. And, really everybody was doing as much as they could, as fast as they could. It's just that, the water was still there. And I think as we think about the actual cleanup and the reconstruction of the interstate and most of the major roads, they were very, very quick in getting that back opened up to traffic.
And not only did the flood affect the lives of those living along the river, it also impacted the land. We'll bring Mahdi Al-Kaisi into the conversation. He's an associate professor and extension soil management expert with Iowa State. He joins me from our Ames studios. Welcome.
Thank you.
Professor, driving down Interstate 29 in western Iowa and looking out at the farm fields, you can see how great the impact is on these fields. Corn and soybean fields are just covered in what looks like beach sand. What kind of impact does that river bottom sand and silt have on these farm fields, on this land?
Generally, accumulation of sand will have a chemical and physical change to the soil properties.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, when you have significant amount of sand accumulated in the soil surface, that will be very difficult to manage, and it requires significant removal of process. If it's more than 12 inches, need to be removed and cleaned. Otherwise, will affect the crop, even crops start emerging with high wind, a dry condition. The sand particles will plaster these crops and create significant amount of damage.
And so what's the possible treatment here?
There are several treatments. If the amount of sand accumulated on the soil surface 2 inches or 4 inches, that could be incorporated through tillage practices and incorporated in the soil to reduce the accumulation on the surface. And eventually will give a better condition for holding moisture capacity in the soil. And if it's more than 12 inches, most of the recommendation and the previous work was done, it requires some removal, piling the sand in a separate area to be removed. Otherwise, will be very detriment to the productivity.
Where can that sand go? I mean, are there projects that can be used for?
Definitely, it could be trucked to some areas where there is a need for it. And some of the areas, the lower bottom areas close to the river bottom, that's mostly high clay texture soils. Mm-hmm. These kind of soils very difficult to grow a decent crop. That could be spread and incorporated in these soils in if the transportation and the cost become very prohibiting to do that.
Yet I was out in southwestern Iowa getting a look firsthand at some of these crops, and a lot of crops are planted. A lot of soybeans and corn are sprouting up. Explain how that's possible.
Some of these fields not generally affected by a lot of sand accumulated in the soil surface. Mm-hmm. But the real effect is going to be what we call the flooded soil syndrome, which is similar to what we call the fallow syndrome. And that was actually observed in the 1940s in wheat fields when the soil left bare without any crop growing. That's developed a decline, significant decline in some of the fungi that's essential to cycle the nutrients in the soil system. So when the soil flooded to extended period of time, like what we have the last period we had this year and early or last part of last year, mm-hmm. over 100 days, that's kill every plant. And when you don't have a root system growing, that will decline these mycorrhizae or these fungi to cycle the nutrients. So you create a lot of a nutrient deficiency and you don't have a good crop productivity in that soils.
So will farmers be able to get the soil back to the condition it was before the flood?
It could be. It's going to take time. The soil is very resilient system. But some of the treatment and some of the management practices like cover crop and not leaving the soil bare for extended period of time, that will help rejuvenate these microbial communities. Also, farmers, they need to do a good soil testing, especially for phosphorus. Soil affected by flood, you will see significant deficiency in phosphorus. So soil testing is going to be critical. And even if the soil test is high, this is chemically extracted phosphorus, but it's not readily available to the plants. So you need these fungi to recycle this complex phosphorus into soluble form. The root system can uptake it and help the plants to grow.
And this summer you'll be documenting the level of damage. Tell me a little bit about your research and what you're conducting. Yeah.
What we have, actually, we have a collaborative project between Iowa State Extension and University of Nebraska. And we have several sites. We will be implementing several treatments to provide a large-scale demonstration and research to document the effect of flooding on a crop productivity. We will be using cover crop in some of these treatments on a flooded and not a flooded areas to look at the impact of cover crop. Also, we'll be using different treatments with different right nitrogen rates, the response to nitrogen, and also different rates of phosphorus. And also with the soybean, we will be using some inoculants, which is help to promote and grow some more microbial community in the root system. So these are some of the ideas we will be trying this summer. We have several sites between the two states. We have a joint team from Iowa State University Extension and University of Nebraska will be working on this project.
And we've been visiting with Mahdi Al-Kaisi. He's an associate professor and extension soil management expert at Iowa State. And you're listening to River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Clay Masters, sitting in for Ben Kiefer today. Are you a farmer? Were you affected by this flood or another in Iowa? We want to hear from you. Give us a call and join our conversation at 866-780-9100. And I want to bring a farmer who was affected by the flood into the conversation. Scott Olson farms near Takema, Nebraska, on the other side of the river, and is the owner of Lee Valley Farm Equipment. Scott, thanks for being here.
Good afternoon. Happy to be here.
You're still happy to have you. You're still cleaning up. Put into perspective for our listeners what you went through and how much you lost.
Well, we had a total of about 500 acres underwater and a lot of damage on quite a bit of it. I've got 60 acres that we have not been able to get back onto yet. The sand is anywhere from 12 to 15 feet deep with a lot of debris. The main field where our irrigation pivot sets, well, we did about a third of that field for basically 150 acres. We had some holes in that thing, 350 to 400 feet wide, 35 to 40 feet deep, and up to a quarter mile long. So we had a lot of debris to remove, a lot of holes to fill in, a lot of dirt to pick back up off the soils, so the sand that was deposited out across the fields and put back in. We worked at it for quite a while.
With that big of a mess to clean up, how do you even prioritize?
Well, just like you kind of like cleaning your house. You got to start someplace and don't quit till you end, I guess.
And how much did this impact your crop for last year, and how much do you think it'll impact this year's yields?
Well, we had absolutely zero down our last year off that 500 acres. I had some corn that was 2 feet tall and some soybeans that was 6 to 8 inches tall. Had a beautiful crop down there. And it was all consumed slowly by the water as the water backed in on it. As the water got higher, the river bends pretty hard right by our place there, and it just, the water, instead of following the river, it was coming across the ground and just going right across the river and right straight back into Iowa again.
And I should say, as a side note, Iowa Public Radio is a part of Harvest Public Media, a collaboration of Midwest public radio stations. A reporter from Nebraska, Grant Gerlach, was recently out at your field a couple months ago. There's a story that we'll throw on our Facebook site so you can hear a little bit more from Scott and kind of take an audio tour of his farm. We'll put that up on our Facebook page. And Scott, I want to ask you, too, just about, you know, what do you do with all of this sand that accumulates? How do you find any kind of an outlet for it?
Well, that's still a problem on that bottom 60. That's what we haven't figured out yet. I've got a little bit of wasteland to the south of it I can move it onto, but I've got such a large deposit of sand that it would cost more to move it than the land would ever possibly be worth. The course is we cannot dump it back into the river because it is contaminated. It's where it come from, but that's what they tell us. It's kind of frustrating. I've done a lot of work with a lot of area farmers up and down the river. As we were working on ours, I had some other folks that were working on theirs. So we traded a lot of ideas, what was working, what was not working. Just kind of a common web up and down the river, just trying to figure out how to handle it and what was working the best and what was the most cost effective.
And have these been mostly out-of-pocket expenses? Do you have any kind of disaster aid?
The emergency conservation program was enacted. I had a chance back in October, to go back to Washington, D.C. with the Soil Science Society of America and our county extension agent, John Wilson, and we got to go back and give a presentation through the Senate and House and through our staffers' meetings back there about what was going on. That was before the conservation program was funded. It has since then been funded. We have been notified we will get some money. We do not know how much for sure. We've got approximately $210,000 out-of-pocket cost, and all this cost has to be paid, have receipts, canceled checks, the whole 10 yards to prove that we did it before any money can come back to us. So, yeah, we've got a lot of out-of-pocket costs.
And in conversations we've had earlier, that you say this is going to cost the taxpayers a little bit. What's your thinking on that?
Well, some people tell me I exaggerate on this, but this will cost more money than 9/11. The amount of years that it's taken to do this, the amount of dollars that has been spent to stop the flooding early, everybody, the cost through the Corps There are environmental programs, there are flood programs. It just takes so much money, and it's all taxpayers' dollars. The emergency conservation program is all tax dollars. So, you know, it's just going to take a lot of money out of the public funding through the taxpayers. A lot of it out of there.
I want to bring Alan back into the conversation. Is Alan not there? Okay. We don't have Alan anymore. But so tell me a little bit about your neighbors in the area as well. Is everybody experiencing similar problems? And some of the towns in the area, have they felt impact from last year's flood, rather?
Oh, absolutely. You know, they say that the ag dollar turns seven times in a community before it leaves or before it moves on or whatever. So there's taken a lot of money out of the smaller towns. I know there's a county, I believe it's Fremont County in southern Iowa. They've taken for the ground that the Corps has bought, when the Corps buys this ground, they pay no taxes. They've taken $175,000 off the tax rolls. Same way with Burke County. We've lost a lot of tax money coming in. Taxes have been lowered on this land for a while. Some of it will not be farmed again and not be able to be taxed where it should. So, yeah, there's a lot of huge, huge impact across the whole economy through the small towns.
And again, if you're just joining us, we're talking with Scott Olson, who farms near Takema, Nebraska. Are you a farmer? We would like to hear from you. Call us at 1-866-780-9100. Or if you live in one of those towns, give us a call if your town felt impact from some of the flood. Or if you were impacted from a previous flood, we'd like to hear you from you. 1-866-780-9100. And Scott, there's also, we're going to talk later with somebody also that's a part of a group that you're in called the Responsible River Management. That's a group of farmers and business owners. Tell me a little bit about that group.
Responsible River Management is trying to advocate a little bit better responsibility for the management of the river. You know, the farmers are very good environmentalists. You know, we're pretty much stewards of the land. The money that is being spent on studies, fish and wildlife, compared to flood control, management of the river, it needs to be fine-tuned a little bit in our thoughts. And, you know, like I said, I'm not nothing against the environment. But everybody needs a little bit of help up and down that river. They talk about everything being in the floodplain. Well, Sioux City was built in the floodplain. Omaha, Council Bluffs, that's all floodplain. Kansas City, that's a floodplain. So, you know, we can't move everything out of the floodplains.
And really quick, wrapping up, Marty, I'm curious, has there been any estimates about how much this is going to cost for some of the soil work you have to do?
Well, there is no real estimate on the damages, because most of the costs will be a long-term cost for the soil productivity. And that's going to take time, really, to have a good estimate what this is going to cost.
All right, Scott and Marty, thanks for joining me. You're listening to River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. We're out in western Iowa, or at least we're talking about western Iowa today. We're discussing the recovery along the Missouri River. It's been a year since last year's massive flood, and people living along the river are still cleaning up. I made it out to western Iowa a couple weeks ago to talk with a lot of folks out there about the cleanup. But it's also brought up questions about how the river is managed. It's, of course, managed by the Army Corps of Engineers, and it takes its orders from Congress. To help us better understand the background on this massive issue, we have Michael Mack joining us by phone. He is the chairman of the Missouri River Recovery Implementation Committee. It's a tongue twister, so they call it Mr. Rick. Michael, thanks for being here.
Nice to be here.
So tell us about the Missouri River Recovery Implementation Committee and what it's set up to do.
committee was authorized by Congress in the Water Resources Development Act of 2007, and it is a committee made up of the states, tribes, the federal agencies, and stakeholders that all have some vested interest in the Missouri River Basin. So it's quite a large group. We have the eight states. We have 29 authorized tribes to be involved in the committee. And then we have a group of 28 stakeholders as well as 14 federal agencies. So it's quite a large group. And we discuss issues on recovery of the Missouri River and the endangered species on the river, and try to make recommendations to the federal agencies, mostly to the Corps for the management, and the Fish and Wildlife Service is also a lead agency because of the Endangered Species Act.
And it was set up originally to do more than it's doing now, is that correct?
Yeah, we had two major mandates in the authorizing legislation. One was to help the Corps of Engineers on a study to get some sort of ecosystem restoration going on the river as a whole. And then second is to advise the Corps on their management of the river and the recovery of the three species that are threatened and endangered on the river. That's the pallid sturgeon and then two species of birds, the piping plover and the least tern.
So there's so many interests involved here. How do you work to get everybody on the same page?
Well, it's challenging, needless to say, but I think this is kind of the direction that natural resource management is going. It, you know, just no longer works to put out rule changes out there that, you know, people don't have the ability to buy in or at least have an impact on as they're being formed. So we try to take members' interests at heart. We make sure that we have what's called consensus recommendations, which means any member of the group can block a recommendation. Any single member can block a recommendation that goes to the federal agencies about a management strategy that they may be employing.
Can you give any kind of example of a slice that everybody agreed on?
Well, for example, one of our recommendations was a recommendation to the Fish and Wildlife Service to consider what they call a similarity of appearance listing. We have a fish in the Missouri River called the shovelnose sturgeon, which at a very is a smaller sturgeon than the pallid sturgeon, which is the endangered sturgeon, but they look very, very much alike, particularly comparing a shovelnose sturgeon to a young pallid. And there was a significant commercial industry for shovelnose sturgeon for caviar because their eggs, sturgeon eggs, are you know, prized as caviar. And so there was concern that there was take of pallid sturgeon going on in this commercial fishery for the shovelnose sturgeon. So our recommendation to the Fish and Wildlife Service is to help protect the pallid sturgeon because there's so few out there. We feel you need to list the shovelnose sturgeon in what they call a similarity of appearance, and so it was protected as well. And that was one of the recommendations that the committee sent up to the federal agencies.
Now, Michael, I don't want you to go anywhere. I want to come back to you, but I do want to bring Leo Edelman into the conversation. He's a farmer near Percival, Iowa, in the southwestern part of the state. He and other farmers and business owners, we talked about it a little bit earlier in the show, they band together to form the group Responsible River Management. Leo was kind enough to let me sit in on a meeting a couple weeks ago. Leo, thanks for being here.
Well, glad to be here. Thank you.
And one of the consensus that I really felt from being at that meeting is that you feel that there's too much attention being spent on environmental concerns. Would you elaborate on that?
Well, we've felt that in the past there certainly has. There's been a lot of attention brought to that since the 2011 flood. There's been some budget issues been brought out on the amount of money that has been spent on the Missouri River Recovery Program versus operations and maintenance. And, I want to make it very clear, there are eight authorized purposes on this system, and there's a very complex complex system that the Corps of Engineers have to deal with. And it all comes down to balance in the system, and it is a very tough job. And that is a lot of what the Mr. Rick Committee has done with Mr. Mack. I've sat in on the January meeting in Kansas City. One of our board members is David Zeke, who is the vice chair of Mr. Rick. We visited with Sean Chouse, who is from Iowa State Extension, who is Governor Branstad's appointee to Mr. Rick. Also, I've visited with numerous other members of Mr. Rick, and it is a very complex system. However, we feel that there is not a lot of balance anymore when it comes to recovery versus operations and maintenance.
And I also want to bring Jim Redmond into the conversation. He's with the Northwest Iowa Sierra Club. He's also a representative on the Missouri River Recovery Implementation Committee. He joins us from our Ames studios. Jim, welcome.
Hello.
And in our conversations that we've had for the reports that I've been doing on this, you were saying that you can't really pit this people versus species here.
Right. Even your characterization of the issue, water wars, I don't think that this is a war. This is an occasion. We suffered a great deal in the flood of 2011. We need to understand why it happened the way it did, and we need to sit around the table with lots of people to get a sense of that. I want to second what Leo said, and that is it's complex. To deal with that, the complexity of the Missouri River, Congress mandated this recovery committee that Mr. Mack is chair of. And we might mention that the stakeholders represent the diverse interests, as many diverse interests as we could get around the table. That included barge industry, power plants, environmental organizations. So it's a range of people who are at that table attempting to find answers that everybody can agree with. It's a very tough task, but we've been operating for 4 years, and we have managed to arrive at consensus and had some effect on how the river may be managed.
And I don't want to get too much in the weeds here, but we're throwing around these terms. Mr. Mack, that's different than the Missouri River Recovery Implementation.
No, I meant Mike Mack, okay?
Oh, Mike Mack. Okay,
yes.
Yeah.
Excuse me. It was not an acronym.
So what do you feel, how do you analyze this to find some kind of answer for how it's best managed?
Well, the first thing is you don't jump to conclusions. I think that what we had in 2011, a great number of people were suffering. This was the first time that the entire system, the reservoir system in Dakotas and Montana, suffered at the same time that people in the lower basin. So this was a flood that affected just huge numbers of people up and down. And the need here was not to, I think the tendency when you're suffering economic damage or there are public safety concerns is that you scapegoat. You try to find a single answer that you work at. And that's what happened. And unfortunately, neither the recovery committee that, I serve on nor the Army Corps successfully responded to those, conclusions about the cause of the flood. So the first cause that they identified was the Corps paying too much attention to the species. Well, that's very, very inaccurate in terms of the decisions that were made in the spring of 2011. Then they moved to the Army Corps, mismanagement by the Corps. They should have been releasing waters, So the tendency is to find these simple answers when we should be looking for a complex of 12 or 15 reasons that we suffered so much last year.
And I want to bring Mike Mack back into the conversation. What are some of the answers that you're seeking to move forward with this?
Well, answers are certainly hard to come by. I think, you know, we discuss issues, and I think the strength of the committee and the way we've structured it is to bring as much information as possible in front of the group before they, you know, weigh in on an issue. And so, for example, we're looking right now at the potential for the interior lease turn to perhaps be downlisted in the future from its threatened condition. And so, you know, the committee is, you know, relies on the Fish and Wildlife Service. They're doing a review of the status of the species. But the chances are that other members, other scientists will weigh in front of the panel and in front of the committee and have an opportunity to talk about what, you know, their findings are, what kind of information they have, what kind of data sets tell us what about is going on with the population of the birds across the country. So I think our strategy of information sharing is very important when it comes to looking at an issue, let's say, as, you know, an endangered species listing.
And if things don't change and we experience the kind of rainfall that we had last year, can we expect another flood like the one in 2011, and how soon?
Clay, that's exactly the question, that people recognize not only that they suffered the ravages of 2011 waters, they don't want to have to go through that again. And so we're very concerned because, well, American Rivers identified the Missouri River as one of its most endangered, not because of the flood, but because of the political leadership after the flood. The political leaders, and remember, Congress runs the Corps. It's not like a TVA or some other arrangement. The Corps has to get its orders from Congress. And so political leadership is extremely important, and they seem to have adopted a kind of simple answer, which is flood control has priority. Well, many, many other contributing factors have to be looked at, and flood control has half a dozen different meanings, and the governors and congressional delegations seem to be backing off the hard work of dealing with a range of issues instead of just making press releases.
And this, you're listening to River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about the recovery along the Missouri River. It's been a year since last year's massive flood, and people living along the river are still cleaning up. But we're talking about some of the questions that it's brought up about how the river is managed. A little bit ago, we were talking with Leo Edelman, a farmer, and you can drive around southwest Iowa and see some of these farm fields and how much they've suffered from that. Leo, what needs to be done in your opinion?
Well, I'd like to point out it's not just the farm fields. It was the entire infrastructure, mm-hmm. roads being closed, washed out, houses. Large number of people in our particular area here in Fremont County work on the Nebraska side. The commute back and forth was devastating. And our concern is not just the flood of 2011. It's things have transpired even before that. Four of the last 5 years, we've been in a high river environment. Our levees have cranked down gates, manually cranked down whenever we get into high river environment. Those gates are closed to keep the water from backing up into our and on the dry side of the levee. And then our interior drainage is plugged up. And it seems to be more and more often, right during the normal June runoff, we get a lot of, that's our normal heavy rain event also. So we, between the seepage from under the levee and normal rainfall, our crops are just devastated. We just simply have no way to recover from that, even though there has not been a full-fledged breach like there was in 2011. And a lot of this, we feel, is because of timings of releases. The Corps has come up with the spring pulse, which mimics the annual runoff prior to the reservoir systems, and that has a lot to do with our problems.
And Jim, we had talked about earlier in one of our conversations about how the river is handicapped and it needs to – you can't – I believe you said you can't tame it. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, again, American Rivers identified outdated flood management practices. And if you think about it, in the 19th century, women's fashions were governed by a very, very pinched waist, okay, from the corsets. And what we have in the river south of Gavin's Point, south of Ponca State Park,
and
is a very pinched and narrowed river. And that, mistakenly, people think of it as a flood control infrastructure. But indeed, it's just the opposite. It is not. It has a capacity. And one of the recommendations that the Corps came up with is that we obviously need a channel with more capacity. And the biggest lesson from 2011 is comparing a segment of the river, the Missouri National Recreational River, that did not flood. It was a 60-mile segment. From Gavin's Point Dam down to Ponca. It was bank full, but you didn't have the damage. You didn't have the suffering because you had a wider channel. You had some capacity there.
And this is up in the, for folks that aren't looking at a map, this is in the northeast part of Nebraska. It kind of sets the line for where Iowa and Nebraska and South Dakota all come together.
So we have a tremendous contrast between what was going on with 160,000 cubic feet per second in the Missouri National Recreational River. It was that channel could deal with that kind of flow. And immediately south of there, where you had a very narrow channel, that's where the suffering began. And you had, according to geological surveys, one of the early studies of the flood, the Iowa-Nebraska segment had like a 500-year flood that it was dealing with. That's the amount they were Dakota Dunes, Sioux City, all those areas down to Fremont County. Iowa and Nebraska suffered the most in the flood because of the amount of structures close to the floodplain and, again, no connectivity with the floodplain. We didn't have a functioning floodplain because we had pinched that channel down to 300 feet, 400 feet, just a very narrow channel. It used to be half a mile wide.
And we're visiting with Jim Redman. He's the Northwest Iowa Sierra Club representative. And I also want to transition back to Mike, Mack. He's the chairman of the Missouri River Recovery Implementation Committee. And one thing that we haven't really talked about right now, and I wanted to bring up just because it was something that came up a lot in my reporting, is just there's also some navigational interests that we've kind of touched on too. And there people don't really think of the Missouri as having many barges on it, but there is still a little bit south of Kansas City. Is that right, Mike?
Well, actually, from Sioux City, Iowa, all the way down to St. Louis is a navigation channel. That is, kept open for commercial usage for from March through November. That has to be a certain depth of water, so they have to maintain a certain flow in there, and it's a certain depth. So, we do have a navigation channel, and that is one of the authorized purposes of the river.
And we keep throwing around authorized purposes. Those are the they were set up. There are eight of them. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, the Pick-Sloan Act of 1944 set up a series of authorized purposes, and navigation and flood control were obviously two of the big ones, but there were eight total.
And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the Missouri River, the flooding that happened last year and its impact. I want to thank my guests. The conversation could go on for hours, I'm sure. You can find more from our reporting at iowapublicradio.org. Thanks to Mike, Jim, and Leo for joining me today.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Catherine Perkins, and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today came from Allison Sullivan. Technical support comes from Dennis Reese and Jason Burns. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River are available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. Thanks for joining us.